The Guardian.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for April the 14th. Coming up on this week's show, when did the Western world start to think scientifically? Philip Ball joins us to shed light on a crucial but hidden story in the history of rational thought. Also in the show...
The biblical history is that dinosaurs and people, because all land animals and people are made on the same date, they lived at the same time.
Ken Ham from the creationist group Answers in Genesis tells us about dragons, dinosaurs, and why he believes the Earth is only 6,000 years old. Plus, we hear from Peter Higgs, yes, him of the boson fame, about his celebration plans if physicists do discover the so-called God particle at CERN. And we'll find out why 20% of scientists admit to using brain-enhancing drugs. Stand by for an experience, hallucinogenic or otherwise. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back to the science podcast that's soft, strong and very, very long. After a few weeks of winging it, I'm delighted to say that the pod's back to full strength. James Randerson is the science correspondent of The Guardian. Feeling strong, Jimbo?
Oh yes, and very long.
Returning from a holiday involving skiing, sailing and probably plenty of Scrabble, it's Nell Bose from The Guardian's arts team. Hi, Nell.
Hello, plenty of melted cheese.
Good, good. You're looking healthy. In demand from every podcast, but back home where he feels most comfortable, it's Bobby Techno Johnson. All right, Bobby?
Yeah, coming back, it's like one of those Hovis adverts.
Yeah,
I feel
right.
You know, coming upstairs with a bit of music.
Your bicycle is outside and there's a loaf of bread somewhere, I'm assuming. Also joining us in the pod this week is our special guest, the science writer Philip Ball. Now, Phil's written in the past about social physics, molecular chemistry, and applying scientific and mathematical methods to everyday phenomena. For his next book, though, he's turned to history. The traditional view of how science developed has it that it started somewhere among the philosophers of ancient Greece and was then reinvented during the Renaissance and Enlightenment just a few hundred years ago. But Phil thinks that this story misses out a crucial part of the picture. Phil, welcome to the pod. Tell us about what happened in the 12th century that no one seems to remember.
Well, the popular view misses it, and you've given the popular view, and you know that's the one that a lot of people tend to learn at school. Historians know that it's not true, but I think it's not generally known that actually the Middle Ages wasn't this sort of age of superstition and irrationalism that was displaced by the Renaissance. There was a strong element in the Middle Ages, particularly in the early Middle Ages, of rationalism. It was really then that the Western world acquired a kind of scientific way of thinking.
So it was more of a scientific way of thinking rather than laws and the sort of theories that we might assume is part of normal science now.
It was, but it led to what you can clearly see as the early beginnings of science. So in the 12th century, when this sort of rationalism really started to emerge strongly, that led on to the 13th century, where there were people like Roger Bacon and Robert Grosseteste doing experiments in optics that, you know, can be seen as the beginnings of the physical exploration of that area of the natural world.
So why is it that we associate Newton with optics and gravity and all these sorts of things when some of these experiments might have come hundreds of years before?
I think that it's a combination of things. I think for one thing, you know, this whole idea of the Renaissance being the sort of reemergence of rationalism was something that was actually very much promoted by the Renaissance historians themselves, and then was again sort of promoted, particularly during the 19th century, by historians who were very keen to present a sort of what we call a positivistic idea of science, that it was progress that was, you know, dispelling clouds of superstition, and the Middle Ages kind of ended up as the fall guy for that narrative. But I think it's very clear that that's not true at all. In the 12th century, there was an influx of texts from the classical world, from Greek and Roman philosophers, that were being translated into Latin so that Europeans could read them, often from Arabic texts where they'd been preserved in translation. And this sort of led to a reemergence of interest in the ideas of classical philosophy, the sort of interest in nature and natural philosophy, and in particular the idea of rationalism in the universe. And the key idea really was that the universe is a rational system. So no one really in the 12th century doubted that ultimately God was responsible for it. But they started to think that rather than, if you like, sort of making it up every day as he went along, he'd laid down rules, rational rules that governed the way the universe was worked, and that we could investigate nature and find out what those rules were.
Who were the movers in this area? I mean, you say in an upcoming essay in Nature that by 1300, the foundations of a scientific worldview had been laid. But who was doing that sort of philosophy?
It happened largely in France. That was really the sort of intellectual centre of Europe in the 12th century, and in particular in the cathedral schools. So, you know, these were theologians. These were clearly religiously inclined people. But some of them started to read these classical works and to think in this new way. In particular, I've focused in my new book on the Cathedral School of Chartres, where a lot of this thinking started to come about. It's interesting that it started there because Chartres Cathedral was one of the first classic High Gothic cathedrals. And I've suggested that in some ways, Gothic architecture is a reflection of this idea of an orderly universe.
James, you're a scholar of science. Did you know about the Chartres Cathedral's history, importance in the history of science?
I didn't, actually, but what I wanted to ask was about the... you mentioned some experiments on optics. I mean, to what extent were people starting to develop the idea of experiment and testing theories and, you know, trying to knock them down at this stage?
Well, experiment is a very sort of tricky term right through the Renaissance, not just the Middle Ages, in the sense that often what people meant by experiment, they might mean doing something practically, but often that was just a demonstration. That was just there to sort of demonstrate what they sort of already believed to be true. And in fact, there was also quite a belief that in some sense, our mundane world of everyday stuff was an inferior sphere relative to a sort of transcendental realm where everything was perfect. And so people often took the view that if experiment didn't show you what you had expected, there was something wrong with the world, something wrong with the experiment rather than something wrong with your ideas.
Well, these lovely, clear ideas, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it's very hard to sort of pin down when experiments started in the modern sense of the word, you know, experiments that might disprove an idea. But certainly in the 13th century, you can find people doing, you know, making sort of tests on the everyday world in optics, for example. It was then that some of the philosophers started to understand some of the basic ideas behind the formation of the rainbow. You know, again, we sort of tend to attribute this to Isaac Newton, but a lot of the thinking had gone on before him.
It's interesting, isn't it, that actually a lot of the thinking, what you're describing, is just simply people's attempts to get closer to God, in a way, or to see his majesty, is it?
Well, this was one of the key things, really, that, you know, all of this was ultimately sort of motivated from a religious perspective. But the idea of the progressive thinkers was that you were actually sort of showing your sort of veneration of God by finding out about his creation. And they would argue that if you turned your back on the world and, you know, assumed that we couldn't know anything and you were essentially just a mystic about it, then in a sense you were not honouring this sort of wonderful creation that God had wrought, that we had almost a moral obligation to find out about how God had created the world.
Bob, you've got something to ask?
Yeah, I was just wondering about this, you know, now we're aware of this horrible execution of the Middle Ages as a taken out of history. I just wondered if you thought, you know, that was the work of maybe Renaissance propagandists who wanted to kind of point out their religious change and everything, or whether it's just maybe there's less source material, you know, since the invention of the printing press, there's a lot more of it out there. So maybe there's just less evidence of this that survived through to modern times.
I think there's a bit of both. I mean, there's certainly a lot of gaps in our knowledge about the Middle Ages. In particular, it's very hard to establish whether there were very sort of direct links between the sort of thinkers in cathedral schools who were, you know, developing this rational thought and the sort of artisans, the people who are building the cathedrals. You know, that idea seems to have something in it, but it's very hard to establish the direct links. But I think that there's an element of both of the things that you say, that, you know, there has been a lot that has been lost. But I think that it would be unwise to underestimate the degree to which we've essentially bought into the Renaissance way of thinking. You know, they wanted to sort of celebrate their age, and they did that very effectively. They were very effective propagandists and, you know, in some sense, quite explicitly denigrating what had gone before. I mean, it was the Renaissance scholars that gave us the whole idea of Gothic architecture, which to them was a kind of a way of linking it with the vandalization of the Roman Empire by the Goths. Actually, Gothic architecture had nothing to do with the Goths as such. It came from France. It was Frankish, not Gothic. But, you know, this was all part of, if you like, a sort of campaign to establish the Renaissance as the era, you know, the enlightened era after this sort of morass of superstition.
Can't believe it. We've been taught lies, all of us. We're just believing, we're believing all sorts of things. Phil, we're going to leave that there for now. We're going to definitely come back to some of this later in the show, though. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come...
I would like to emphasise that the actual Higgs boson discovery, if it happens, is just one part of the programme. There's vastly more for the machine to do.
We hear from Professor Peter Higgs and find out the latest news about the Large Hadron Collider. Plus, dinosaurs in the Garden of Eden and having a dig at Dawkins. We hear from one of America's most vocal creationists, Ken Ham. That's all coming up. But first, here are some of the other science stories that have been making headlines over the past 7 days. Here's Nell and Bobby with your News Jam.
News Jam.
A government commissioned study into a controversial DNA profiling technique has recommended that it is scientifically robust. Low-copy DNA analysis can establish a profile using far fewer cells than usual. The forensic method was briefly suspended last year after the judge in the Omar bombing trial questioned its credibility.
Scientists in New York have found a drug which can protect healthy cells from radiation. The discovery could improve the effectiveness of radiation therapy in treating cancer and help prevent radiation sickness after exposure to a nuclear accident or attack.
A milder form of fertility treatment that's safer for women also results in higher quality embryos that are more likely to develop successfully. That's according to researchers who compared the method with conventional approaches. They say the technique, which is cheaper because it uses lower doses of hormone-mimicking drugs, should be used more widely by fertility clinics.
And finally, who said scientists don't know how to enjoy themselves? One in five people who responded to a survey in the journal Nature admit to having used brain-enhancing drugs without a prescription to improve their concentration, memory, or problem-solving skills. The authors of the study said the use of drugs such as Ritalin and Provigil was not confined to the academic world, and a recent government report predicted the use of mind-altering substances would become as common as coffee.
Nell and Bobby, thank you very much. Let's go into a little bit more detail on some of those. James, the DNA story has been a long-running one. Can you just quickly summarise it for us?
Well, low-copy number DNA essentially uses the same sort of technique as standard DNA fingerprinting analysis, but you multiply up the DNA more, essentially, before you do your analysis. Now, that's fine because it means that you can amplify DNA from tiny samples in just a few skin cells, for example, so maybe from a left behind on a fingerprint or something like that. But it does mean that you're more likely to get contamination in there, and it means that, you know, particularly in a kind of complex chain of custody where a sample is being moved around from one lab to another, the chances of getting some kind of false reading go up. And so
if there's a random piece of DNA in there, that will also get multiplied up and
that's right, and you can get mixing between two different profiles, so, which give you strange results.
So in the Omar bombing case, they found that perhaps this technique was incorrectly used. What was the result of that?
Well, the judge was pretty scathing at the trial, and more he was, I think, criticising the police over the way that evidence had been handled and the way it had been transferred, that, you know, basically the chain of custody had not been prosecuted correctly and not done carefully. You know, things, items of evidence were just kind of left in vans and that kind of stuff. But he also had, expressed doubts about the technique itself, and so, you know, it was put under review, and this is the result of that. And they've basically come back and said, well, actually, we think that the technique is robust. But I think there are still some doubts within the scientific community. I mean, for example, not all jurisdictions accept this kind of evidence. They say it's still, you know, too tentative. And there is always more of a danger of contamination. And I think, you know, forensic scientists need to be aware of the potential for problems.
Phil, is it? Do you think that is it forensic scientists who need to be more aware, or should people in courts themselves be more aware of the limitations of stuff like DNA fingerprinting for use in criminal cases?
Well, as I understand it, it's been a huge problem to use this technique in an informed way, because the issues are subtle and scientific. And so you can't necessarily expect the legal process to be able to handle them straight away. So, I guess this sort of just illustrates that there's still work to be done to, you know, educate people about the. I think the part of the problem is that scientific techniques acquire very quickly a sort of patina of authority that
right.
then becomes very hard to question.
You put the word science on something and it sort of makes it so seem completely believable.
Yeah, and you know, the fact that part of that science involves questions of probability and uncertainty is something that's, you know, that often seems a bit of a contradiction.
Yeah, well, I agree with that, actually. I mean, I think, you know, we've seen that fingerprint evidence isn't infallible, you know, all of these different things. Unfortunately, I think the thing is when you put something in front of a jury, they look at science and they say, oh, fantastic, this is a way for us to not have to make a decision. It will tell us black or white, one way or the other, is this person guilty or not? You know, unfortunately, juries have to still really do have to make a judgment. The question is really, you know, how small is the variance? How accurate is the science likely to be?
How confident are the results? I mean, that's essentially what it comes down to. We'll move on from that, though. The drugs story, James, in Nature. I'm going to come to our Nature person just in a second here, but
we've got two Nature people,
former Nature people. But quickly, this drug story. It was Nature readers admitted to taking perfectly legal drugs, Ritalin and Provigil, to boost up what their mental states or something whilst doing science. Is that what it was?
Well, yes, essentially. That.
Rock and roll.
They're legal drugs, but used illegally, if you sort of mean. That's what they were fessing up.
Provigil is essentially a drug that keeps you awake for forever.
Yeah, it treats narcolepsy, and it was licensed in the UK in 1997. Ritalin's for
ADHD.
ADHD. Hyperactive kids, kiddie coke, apparently it's called.
what was the point of this?
Okay, well, this was prompted by a kind of commentary on the use of these kind of brain enhancing drugs last year, in fact. And so Nature did this survey, and they got 1,400 responses. Now, we shouldn't put too much store by it because it's not a kind of random sample of the population. It's people who wanted to respond to the survey online. So, you know, it's probably exaggerating results. But anyway, 20% of those who responded said they had used these drugs. It was Provigil, Ritalin and beta blockers. 70% said they would. I think a third said if their child was at a school where lots of the other kids were using some of these drugs to get better grades, they would consider giving it to their children. So, you know, it kind of certainly showed that the use seems to be fairly widespread, at least.
Well, it was predicted in the Foresight Brain and Cognitive Development study for years ago that these drugs are going to become more and more common. Now, you used to work in the Nature Office. Tell us the inside gossip. Is this crazy? Are they all on kiddie crack? Seriously?
No. They're just devoted to their cause.
I see.
You're that kind of mania. You don't need drugs.
Seriously, do you worry about these sorts of drugs becoming, you know, popular? Did you think that it's a good thing?
Sorry, you're asking me. I'm asking Bobby.
Dude, no.
What did you say again?
You need some more Ritalin, clearly. No, I'll ask that question again.
I need some Provigil today. Like nobody's business.
But seriously, I mean, do you think we should be worried about these sorts of drugs making an appearance in workplaces and that kind of thing?
Keep a general eye on it, but goodness, I mean, it's not as bad as some things. I mean,
that's like caffeine, I suppose, isn't it, Phil?
Well, I'm wondering whether this is, you know, already scientists are required to sort of put disclaimers and, you know, declarations of conflicts of interest and so on their papers. Should we also have declarations this paper was written on and written on?
Sponsored by.
Maybe should be drug tested.
But I mean, I also think, you know, there is a sort of serious aspect to this that that actually is sort of highlighted in this film that I haven't seen yet, but it sounds very interesting, called Dark Matter, which is, you know, looking at the incredible pressures that are on research, particularly sort of postdocs and young researchers now, to achieve and to produce results. And, you know, I think this is partly a reflection of that. I mean, in the film is about a Chinese student in America who just was tipped over the edge by those pressures, apparently, and shot several people, you know, including people in his faculty. But you know, I think this is a common problem now, and this is probably just another aspect of this.
Exactly. Isn't that the real point, is that there's nothing wrong with taking something of your own volition. And, you know, many, many great discoveries or great ideas have been had while in a state of altered consciousness. But if you feel you have to take these drugs...
Because everybody else is.
Yeah. You know, if you're giving them to your kids because everybody else is doing it, then I think that's a slight... You know, that's a very dubious moral question.
That's right, that's right.
I think I'm a little less sanguine than Nell is about them. Because, I mean, they are... After all, prescription drugs that you shouldn't be able to, you shouldn't be using unless you've got the advice of a doctor.
They talk about how they get hold of them.
Yeah, they get hold of them on the internet, basically.
So actually, according to our previous podcast, about 70% of them are absolute rubbish.
Oh, quite possibly. Yeah, yeah. So they can just be having sugar pills. Yeah.
Someone's been listening to the journalism we do on this show. We'll leave that there. We'll make sure that everyone here has a drug test before you leave the studio. James, you went to CERN last week. You lucky bastard. Tell us about that.
Yes, you can. Why not? It's not the BBC.
And you met Peter Higgs. The Peter Higgs. What's he like?
I did meet him. He's a very nice man. He's very shy. He's almost slightly kind of embarrassed, I think, by all the attention that is surrounding him, because obviously he made these kind of theoretical leaps in the 60s, which kind of came up with the Higgs particle and the Higgs field.
Can you tell us what the Higgs particle is?
Yeah, it's a fundamental particle of matter that gives all the others mass.
Right, go on, carry on.
Someone described it as Margaret Thatcher walking through a Conservative Party conference and they all cluster around her.
And it slows her down.
Used to.
It's quite an old description.
These metaphors are getting to it. Anyway, so you met him and then you spoke to him as well.
Yeah, as I say, you know, there's all this attention now because the Large Hadron Collider, which at some point, probably end of June, beginning of July, will be the first proton beam will be switched on. And after, you know, some months after that, they may well have some data from it that proves that the Higgs boson indeed does exist. So there's lots of excitement about it. And, yeah, as I say, I think he's a little bit overawed by the whole thing.
Well, that embarrasses me. I mean, the term God particle was introduced by Leon Lederman in his book, and Lederman claims that he didn't really intend that to be the title. He wanted to refer to it as that goddamn particle, and his editor wouldn't let him, so he just abbreviated it to the God particle. I find it embarrassing because I'm not a believer myself. It's a sort of misuse of terminology, which I think might offend some people.
Peter Higgs there. James, so what was the rest of the atmosphere like when you went round? I mean, were they excited? I mean, I suppose they've been excited for 10 years now, but it's sort of coming up to the home straight.
It's hard to maintain that level.
I'm excited.
I was there for the weekend that they had a public open day, at which they had nearly 70,000 people go to CERN.
That many people interested in particle physics.
It's insane,
isn't it? Superb.
And, but actually, a lot of those people, I think, were a little bit disappointed because there were so many people, they just simply couldn't deal with them. You know, although there are various points around the ring where you can go down into the go down sort of 100, 150 metres and see some of the experiments that are underground, the lifts just couldn't move fast enough. You know, the lifts could only deal with maybe 2,500 people
they
a day.
They can move massive 65,000-tonne supermassers conducting magnets up and down, but they can't...
Even the best of Swiss organisation couldn't get 68,000 people underground in time. But anyway, here's a kind of taste of the atmosphere at CERN.
I'm from France. I never visited CERN. That's why I did came today, for I did read it in the paper.
How far have you come today?
Probably 5,000 miles from the United States. We saw CMS, we saw the LHC ring, we saw Atlas, what life is like at CERN, like the cafeteria and the hostels and everything. We are from Zurich.
Why did you decide to travel so far today to come and see things here?
We have both studied physics, so it was last chance to maybe be able to see the LHC, but there was too many people.
Yeah, so there were big queues, you weren't able to see Atlas or anything like that?
No. There was, they told us around 3 hours waiting time to get the ticket, and this was too much. We actually got to meet Dr. Higgs, who made Higgs theory, so it was pretty exciting. I mean, we didn't get to talk to him for long, but we get to take pictures and meet him, and it was just like a big deal. It was really exciting, especially for people who know, you know, what he's done for physics and that kind of thing. So it's pretty amazing.
Some very excited people at CERN there. Well, we're going to leave that there, but there's going to be plenty of stuff about CERN in the coming weeks from us, so keep your ears peeled for those. Let's wrap all that up there. To have your say on any of these topics, head to the Science blog. That's blogs.guardian.co.uk/science, or post something on our Facebook wall.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
If you've been listening to this podcast for, I don't know, more than a month, you'll know that we don't need much of an excuse to talk about the relationship between God and science. We've heard from a whole manner of rationalists, theologians, and atheists in the past, but it's been quite a while since you've heard from any creationists. Now, James, don't ever let it be said you don't know how to enjoy yourself. Apart from the wonder of CERN, you've also been going to Leicester to meet a very strange man.
Yeah, I get all the best gigs. Yeah, Ken Ham is the head of Answers in Genesis, which is an international organisation that promotes a literal understanding of the Bible. So, you know, he's into 6,000-year-old Earth, you know, a literal interpretation of the Garden of Eden, including dinosaurs that were vegetarian, etc., etc. And it was very interesting to go and hear him speak because, you know, you kind of think, how on earth would anyone go for this stuff? I mean, it's just so cuckoo.
And you're the arch-skeptic, so what happened?
Well, the weird thing is, after about two... I mean, the man has amazing energy. He spoke for sort of 2 hours to this enraptured audience, and by the end of it, I found myself, you know, kind of thinking, well, yeah, maybe...
Oh, my God. Right. Oh, my goodness.
It was weird. I mean, he's Australian, but lives in America, and this kind of Australian drawl was kind of infecting my brain. But anyway, I spoke to him afterwards. The people there were very nice, incidentally. They were all very, very friendly when I spoke to them. But I spoke to Ken Ham afterwards, and he told me about the sort of dinosaurs in Eden image.
The biblical history is that dinosaurs and people, because all land animals and people are made on the same day, so that they lived at the same time. What I explained to people is, number one, that's not so radical anyway, even from a secular scientist perspective, because there's lots of creatures that secular scientists have thought became extinct millions of years ago and they find living today. Creatures that supposedly lived at the time of the dinosaurs, according to them. The other thing is, when you take biblical history and you take that seriously, then there's other ways of looking at things like dragon legends.
So just on the dragon legends point, you're suggesting that some of these dragon legends that are in our cultures are actually real memories of humans living with dinosaurs?
Well, I would say they're real memories of humans living with particular creatures that were called dragons, and I'm suggesting that many of the descriptions of dragons and some of the paintings we see in carvings are very similar to what we would describe as dinosaurs. And because you find lots of flood legends, and everyone knows that we find flood legends, the American Indians, Fijians, Hawaiians, back to the Babylonians and so on, we would say that's because they do have a basis in a real flood, Noah's flood. And we'd say similarly, the dragon legends have a basis in something real. And so we're suggesting it's very possible that many of those legends could have been based upon what we would call today dinosaurs. Because the word dinosaur is a modern word, after all. It wasn't made up until 1841.
I just want to remind everyone we're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. James, well, James, quickly.
Okay. The point here is that, in one sense, it's a very honest view of the world, because he's saying...
No, it's not.
Hear me out. He's saying there's a book which explains everything, so any evidence that you find in the world has to fit with that book. And so, you know, he cherry-picks the evidence, like the dragon legends, the flood legends, cave paintings that look a bit like dinosaurs, and uses them as evidence that, you know, we used to live with dinosaurs. But we moved on to something else, which was Richard Dawkins' point that bringing up children and labelling children in a particular religion, like saying, you know, these are Christian children, is tantamount to child abuse. So I put that to him.
Have you ever walked into the bookstores across England and have a look at how many secular materials are aimed at children? Millions and millions and millions of them. And what Richard Dawkins is saying is that he wants children not to be taught about God, not to be taught about anything like that, and so that he can teach them atheism. If you want to talk about child abuse, I would say that Richard Dawkins is the one responsible for child abuse, because Richard Dawkins wants to train kids that there is no God, there is no purpose and meaning in life, you're just an evolved animal. Why shouldn't they go out and shoot fellow students? Why shouldn't they go and kill their neighbour? Why shouldn't they do whatever they want to do? Why shouldn't they experiment with drugs? He's the one that is involved in child abuse. It's the Christian who is telling people that they have worth, they have value, that murder is wrong, that you need to love your neighbour, you need to have the right attitude towards people, you need to be kind to people. In fact, it's Christians primarily who started hospitals and who started education systems and who reach out to people around the world. From a perspective of an atheist, Richard Dawkins wouldn't have a basis for doing that.
Ken Ham there. Okay, team, let's tear this apart. What do you make of that?
I'm dumbfounded, really. I know that people think in this particular way, but what interests me is really, you know, if the infallibility of the Bible, I don't want to get into the child abuse question because
it's dangerous.
It's dangerous.
Just hype, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But if you're looking at, you know, here is a book that tells you an infallible history of the world, and we need to fit the facts into the book, it just seems like interpretation is such a big part of that. That why do we believe that the book has not been reinterpreted? You know, why is the Bible a solid piece of evidence if we're able to pump into it whatever we like? You know, things change through history. I can see where they're coming from, but they're all loonies.
It's a very calm sort of description there, Nell.
I don't really know where to start, and I also sort of feel that I don't really want to start. I don't want to go and
go on.
Rebut every single point, because it kind of
feels
like you're accepting the premise in a way that is actually not on.
Phil, I'll bring you in on this now. You reckon that creationism is, theologically speaking, not a very clever argument.
Well, I think that's one of the issues that's often missed. You know, as scientists, we sort of have the response that Nell does, where do you start? But I think it's puzzling in a way to me that we don't hear more opposition to these ideas from Christians, from theologians, because it's such a theologically naive idea. And it's really interesting getting a historical perspective on this, particularly, you know, having looked at the theology of the 12th century, where God was unquestionably, to everyone there, responsible for everything. And yet the arguments that were talked about there were so much more sophisticated than the sort of level we see here. And that I think they often expose this as the sort of theologically naive view that it is. I mean, I'm going to let someone from the 12th century sort of say it for me, really. This is Adelard of Bath, who was one of the key translators of classical scientific manuscripts in the West, and clearly an extremely devout person. What he said when there were criticisms raised about this rationalist approach to thinking about the world was, "I do not detract from God. Everything that is from him and because of him. But nature is not confused and without system, and so far as human knowledge has progressed, it should be given a hearing. Only when it fails utterly should there be recourse to God." In other words, only when you can't explain something according to science, according to rational thinking, do you have to bring in God and say, well, you know, God must have done it. And even the conservatives in the 12th century, even those who were very nervous and very wary of this sort of scientific approach to things, even they saw that it was a bad idea to start bringing science into the Bible and to regard the Bible as a work of, if you like, history or natural history. And they criticized the rationalists quite rightly for trying to, for example, develop interpretations of Genesis according to Platonic physics. So, you know, they understood that the Bible and the holy books in general were books about moral instruction and not about, they weren't to be approached as sources of facts about the world.
James, I'm going to leave the last word with you here. At the talk, you sort of mentioned when we were talking about this earlier that perhaps the way he talks, Ken Ham talks, sort of bludgeons you almost into believing what he said. I mean, can you just tell us a bit more about that? Do you think it's more this whole idea is people believe because it's just they're just very motivational speakers that sort of come up with it?
I'm sure that's part of it. I mean, he's you know, I suppose it was quite an inspirational atmosphere in there, and people were, you know, kind of finishing off his sentences. It was quite evangelical, as you'd imagine. I guess his response to Adelard of Bath, I mean, I hesitate to speak for Ken Ham, but I think his his motivation here is that it's a sort of thin end of the wedge argument, that the Bible, as you were saying, gives a kind of moral code for living, Now, if you start cherry picking from Genesis and start asking, well, hang on a minute, how did you fit all the animals onto the ark, and awkward questions like that, then you can start unraveling other bits of the Bible, and then you can start saying, well, maybe it's not bad to kill people, and maybe it's okay to be adulterous. You know, that's his take, that you can't cherry pick the Bible. If you want the morality, and we have to have the morality, then you have to have all the rest too.
But what I find interesting about this is the desperate desire to look rational in all of it. You know, so how did they fit all the animals in the ark? Well, here's a rational description of it, and there's a whole article about it. The attempt to be scientific almost is really bizarre. Well, we're going to leave some of all of that stuff there. If any of this sounds like your type of thing, please tell us it isn't. Then there's plenty more. AnswersInGenesis.org. Just two bits of feedback to which we'd like to draw your attention. No sooner had the powers that be given producer Ben a picture byline for the science blog than he was called a young punk, derided for looking like Ross from Friends and slandered as a serial masturbator. It's not the first time that's happened, mind the Ross from Friends thing, that is. Well, that poster was removed, but it did make us laugh. But on to more sensible matters. XQ posted to tell us what she thought of last week's investigation into regional accents.
Maybe it was just me, but to my ears, Doy from Dudley sounded like he could more likely have been Sven from Sweden. Perhaps it's the influence of the IKEA down the road in Wensbury.
Bex, we can assure you that Dave was 100% bona fide West Midlander.
Yeah, right.
Like me.
Anyway, let's get back to a final word from our guest, Phil Ball. Phil, we alluded earlier to the fact that a lot of these motivation in the 12th century came from trying to understand this mind of God, you know, trying to get closer to him and so on. But these people, these rationalists who were trying to do this, how were they perceived by the more religious? So were they seen as sort of sorcerers or kind of getting close to God and kind of as someone, people to be revered? Or were they seen as dangerous? Or did anyone see the coming schism?
Oh, they were seen as dangerous. There were religious conservatives who really didn't like this idea. And what they particularly didn't like, well, for one thing, it seemed to them that this approach was like trying to second guess what God was up to, which seemed like a deeply impious thing. But for another, it seemed to them that by saying that the world is governed by these physical laws, you're imposing constraints on God's omnipotence. And, you know, God had to be capable of doing anything. This was sort of had to, you know, almost went without question. It came to a point in the 13th century where basically the papacy said, you've got a choice. You've got to choose between Aristotle and God. Which of them sort of governs the way the world works? It was more or less decreed that, you know, one had to give God sort of ultimate power, that, okay, Aristotle might be right about certain things about the world, but ultimately God could override him and do what he wanted. So it was very clearly perceived that this was the emergence of a sort of rational way of thinking and the idea that there were physical laws was a threat to the extent to which God governed the universe.
No?
I actually wanted to come back to a point you were talking earlier about when you talked about the translations coming from the Greek and then via the Arabic world and back into these sort of Frankish scholars in the 12th century. How much dialogue was there between the Chartres and the Arabic world? Was there anything?
There was a lot, yeah. I mean, you know, this is something that's also sometimes missed, that these people, these translators from the West, were working at the fringes of Christendom, as it then was, where it sort of interfaced with the Islamic world. And there was a lot of interaction there. There was trade, there was, there was exchange of intellectual ideas. Most of it, has to be said, coming from the Islamic world into the Christian West. So, you know, there was a lot going on at that fertile border. It wasn't all about the sort of caricature of the Crusades and, you know, a sort of fundamental opposition to one another.
All right, Phil, we'll leave that there. Phil's book, Universe of Stone, is out next month. Well, that's it for this week. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science for links to everything we've discussed in the show. Thanks to James Randerson, Bobby Johnson, Nell Bowes, and our special guest, Phil Ball. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.